This is Gisela Kay from the Grizzly Books podcast, and you're listening to True Crime Bones. We are both South African. We both love true crime. And I'm pretty sure if you love my podcast, you'll love Marissa's. And if you love Marissa's, you'll love mine. So check us both out and enjoy this episode.
Well, hello there, and welcome to True Crime Bones, the Cully and Monique Taken Hostage series, part 4, with me, your host Marissa, also known as Bones. And I'm glad you are back for more, my legendary listeners. Yes, I am talking to you. You are a legend, and I appreciate every single listen. So thank you guys. So, in our previous episode, part 3, we learned about what all transpired on the boat, as well as the fact that Cully and Monique and the other hostages made it to land. What was going on, how they felt, and even though they were on land, details, you can go back on the previous episode if you update. A quick update, but what was happening, and they were still unsure of where they were and what's going to happen next. And that's where this episode takes off, part 4. Now, before I get into what happened next, I'm going to go through who the other hostages were, you know? Just names, age, so you guys know before we continue. With that being said, I would like to apologize beforehand for any mispronunciations of the names, as I know it's a struggle for me. I do apologize, and feel free to let me know. Send me a voice note from how, if any of these names, because they are from different nationalities. Some of them might even be from your country. And so please let me know. So, with that being said, let's get into it. A Muslim separatist group in the Philippines went on to claim responsibility for kidnapping the 21 people, including 10 foreign tourists from a Malaysian island resort on the Sunday evening of the 23rd of April. A spokesman for the Abu Sayyaf group, Abu Ahmad, made the announcement in a radio interview. He warned that there would be more surprises for the Philippine government. However, the group had at that stage made no demands. Malaysia and the Philippines have begun a joint air and sea search for the hostages. The Filipino Defense Minister Orlando Mercado said at that stage they had no idea where they were being held, and they gave out the list of names and the nationalities of those taken from the resort. And you thought as follows. When I give the names, with the age, I mean, this is the age they were when they were taken. So obviously now, 21 years later, not the same age. Okay. Malaysia, Ken Yun Lin, 28 years old. He was a dive master. Then Lung Yaku, was 21 at the time, and he was the cook. Jim Vasulius, I'm so sorry, he was 28 years old, and he was the wildlife ranger. Then we had Sulker Nyan Hashim. I'm trying, I've listened to everyone's names. I'm sorry, you guys. Please send me a voice note. Zulkarnain Hashim, He was a forest ranger. Then Abdul Sulawat was a policeman. Vincent Kwong, a diver. Lee Hock Leong, a cook. And Francis Masinkim. And then Balakrishan Nair. Then from the Philippines, Roland Ula, he was a dive instructor. Then Lucretia Dablo, she was the resort hotel cook. From France, we had Sonia Wedling, a 34-year-old mechanical engineer. Then Stephanie Luisi, he was also a 34-year-old mechanical engineer. So any France people speak French? Let me know. From Finland, Risto Vahanen, a 47-year-old engineer. Then Seppo Frainti, a 51-year-old artist. From Germany, Waller, a 57-year-old geographic teacher. And then his wife Renata Waller, 57-year-old teacher. Mark Waller, 27-year-old investment banker. Then from Lebanon, Marie Moarbis, 32-year-old of Beirut. And she currently lives in Paris, where she was employed with an advertising firm. And then South Africa, Kali Strydom, was 36, a corporate banker, and Monique Strydom, 36, a media company owner. So, I am so sorry for mispronunciation of names. I really tried my best, but I know it ain't okay. So please, if you guys are from, because we like pronounce things also, each country, each language is a different way of pronunciation. And if you're French, Germany, Finland, then send me a voice note. And if you want, I'll even add it in the next next part, because I do feel awful. So now that you guys have an idea of like the wide range of hostages that were taken in by who, and you know, get to know them, I just went through the names, but each one's been deadly. But it makes it more personal. Let's get on to what happened that night. Although it was late evening, the clammy jungle air hung motionless in the clearing where the captives had been ordered to rest for the night. The hostages introduced themselves and spoke for the first time amongst each other. The older German man, Werner Wallert, was optimistic. With so many countries involved, he reckoned, the situation would be resolved quickly. He was convinced that Germany, now a powerful country, would use its influence to secure the release of all of them. I mean, it's always good to have that optimistic person around, you know? And then you get people like me, like the friend, this pessimist, which is like the Frenchman, Stefano Luisi, was less confident of a speedy resolution. He believed their only hope was to try and escape. Kali and Monique, still spooked by the events on the boat, tended to agree with the Frenchman. Obviously, I would too. The introduction and conversation brought a sense of togetherness among the hostages. I mean, can you just imagine? It's like, okay, not familiarity, of course, because you don't know each other, but obviously that sense. I mean, okay, this might sound horrible, but I'd rather go through all of this with a bunch of people than like going through it alone. So it's like, it makes complete sense, you know? Being off the water and on relatively solid if not muddy ground, was also a relief. As it grew dark, they were ushered up onto the veranda of the hut and served bowls of white rice and water. Their first meal in about 24 hours. They were hella hungry. I mean, they were starving and relished the bland offering, stuffing it into their mouths with their fingers. Now me, I need food, you know. Because in my place, I'm all about food. Because I'll probably be that person, be stuffed man, everyone's plate's like, give me the rice, give me. But I'll just be like the first day. Second day, it's like, okay, it's fine. Third day, I might bite a person's leg, who knows? No. After that, the short rebel who had sat with them on the boat showed them into a windowless two-room dwelling. It was empty apart from an old mattress that belonged to the owner. Monique looked around for any signs of their possible location. Perhaps a local calendar or a photograph. Something, you know? The only decoration was a colorful poster of an American pop group. Guess what American pop group? Just... Okay, obviously you guys can't answer me back, but I'm gonna be like Dora Explorer. Imagine me looking at you just for no reason while you have to guess. 1, 2, 3. Did you guess the answer? Yes, it's the Backstreet Boys. Yep, the Backstreet Boys. Pinned up on a bamboo wall. If they had found their way here, she thought then perhaps the hostages were not as cut off from the world after all. I mean, no. Okay. Many, many moons ago, just after the dinosaur roamed, I was like a child. A child going through a back street. I was not even a teenager yet, so I couldn't even reach. I was my preteen. Went through a Backstreet Boys phase myself. And out of every when I first learned about it, it hit me like, out of everything, here's a Backstreet Boys poster. Please let me know, you guys, on the platforms where you're listening to this, if you're able to comment, leave comments, or on my Instagram page, truecrime.bones. I will post a new episode is out, so you can leave comments there if you want to. When last did you hear about the Backstreet Boys? And was this as a surprise to you as it is to me? I mean, now the only thing in the news is like a Britney Spears post on the other side. But yeah, enough about the Backstreet Boys. You rest now. We wait for transport, said the small man, settling down into a cramped hot space with his prisoners, because that sounds fun. The hostages lay pressed close to each other. No one spoke. The only sounds were the quiet rhythmic breathing of those inside the hut and the hooting, scratching, chirping, and screeching of the natural jungle creatures outside. I don't live in a jungle. I do live on a farm, and I know those sounds. Sometimes it gets really creepy. About 2 hours later, they heard the straining of an engine, followed by a commotion outside. Blurry-eyed and still exhausted, the captives scrambled out. It was pitch dark, but they could see a group of at least 100 rebels, some of them children carrying guns, who had collected in the clearing about 50 meters from the hut. They were talking excitedly amongst themselves and pointing at the hostages. Just then, a battered flatbed truck with one working light and no exhaust pump down a jungle path and ground noisily to a halt in front of them. I'm not gonna lie. Even as horrible in condition that truck is, it would have been compared to my first car, a Masters. It's in better condition than when I, honestly. But anyway. A few of the rebels jumped up onto the back of the truck and some of the hostages were helped up. Kali and Monique hung back. The engine revved and strained, but the vehicle remained where it stood, its ball tires spinning to deep grooves into the mud. Yeah, it's dark. Everyone was ordered off, and a few rebels muscled in behind and pushed the half rig back up the path. It left with a group of rebels, but no other passengers. Gully's mind slipped into a hyper-alert mode. Earlier he had seen a bag with what he thought was a silencer and a tangle of thick ropes being offloaded at the camp. He could not get this image out of his head and began to wonder what they would do with these, you know, supplies. Which, of course, I mean, in such a situation, again, thinking the worst of the worst. Who could blame this man? The rebels began talking and shouting loudly, and all at once the camp buzzed with activity. Gully and Monique noticed that some of the women hostages were being led away to a shelter in another section of the camp that was set back from the clearing. Gully grew increasingly convinced that something awful was about to happen and decided to stay where they were, him and Monique. They just sat down on the muddy ground and became invisible in the bustle around them. No one seemed to have noticed that they had been separated from the others. I mean, okay, I most of the time feel like I'm invincible, yeah? Do people notice? But that's the example. Imagine how hectic the situation must be. You can just go sit down, become one with the mud around you, and people are like, gone. While sitting and complaining, obviously the thoughts that ran through Gully's head is like, these women were taken to a different camp to be sexually assaulted. That was the first thing on his mind, and I mean, makes sense that would be. And man, while that and sitting, you know, becoming one with the mud, they scanned the darkness around them and noticed that a smaller rebel with a moustache had dozed off nearby on the ground, with his weapon clutched lazily in his hands. Gully crept over and tried to wake him. Now, first of all, I would try and grab his gun. Not trying to wake the man. He woke him by saying, Gully is like, what's going on? Are we safe? You said you would not rape the woman. The man barely opened his eyes and mumbled, I'm sleepy. Transport overload. No temporary destination. Final destination soon. It will be much better there. That is it. That's all the man said. Now, at least he's honest, but like the part, I'm sleepy. Going off the bed, saying it like it is. Also, for someone that had to go and ask, like, Gully, that's how you wake up someone with those questions and getting that reply. First off, like, I'm sleepy, and then the rest. No, that is not good enough. I woke you up instead of taking your gun to get this kind of answers. Okay. To an emotionally charged Gully, his words basically mean, had like a deeply significant meaning for him. He was sure that when this man said final destination, he meant it in the, you know, final destination movies where you die situation, as that's where you'd go and die. Of die ewige met die onewige verskuif. That is Afrikaans, by the way. Afrikaans saying, for those of my Afrikaans listeners. Which, by the way, I have to add, I do have my South African listeners, but so much from around the world, which is amazing. Back to the story. While that's going on in Kali's head, his mind couldn't stop racing, which obviously he wouldn't. He remembered that Monique had hidden a Swiss Army knife in one of the pockets in the jacket the rebel had given her on the boat. If you remember, it was on the second episode. One of the rebels were actually decently enough to give Monique her jacket. His jacket, which a Swiss Army knife in it. I mean, it was such a lucky find. So, Monique was still wearing the jacket, and he leaned over and whispered to her, give me the knife. What for? I'm going to kill him. I have to kill him before he kills us. I mean, Now he thinks of it, well, there was, he had a kind of opportunity. In that crazy moment, his plan made sense to Monique. If they couldn't flee, the only solution would be to kill the small man, who appeared to be a sort of leader. At least they would have accomplished something before the rest of the rebels to hunt them down and executed them. You know, going out with a bang. But then Monique felt a rising sense of hysteria and rush of the moment, but forced herself to focus. You know? No, she thought to herself. This was not the time. She tried to discourage Kali. They argued through clenched teeth. He determined, pounced, and he's like, no, I'm gonna pounce here and grab it. He's like, this let myself can work. And then he was begging her, just please, you know, do it. And she's like, nope. And she straight up like, no, we're not gonna resort to such drastic actions. And when you try to pounce again, she knows her husband, so nope, you're getting it. So he waited a while. I feel like, you know, it's okay. And then all of a sudden he went in, lunged for the knife in her pocket, and she was still like, I married you, I know you. Because she quickly held his arms tightly, saying that they had lost control and had better get a grip on themselves. Well, having a grip on him, her dad. So Woman knows the thing. And really thought he could get up. You know, when like people, when you're in a situation, you get those people when they're joking, they're like, act like they're about to throw something at you. Yes, the first time you will fall for it, maybe the second time. It's like, what do they say? Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. So obviously he tried punching like twice. He thinks he's going to be acting cool, and then all of a sudden she's going to be fine with it. Anyway. They then calmed down, and that is when they noticed two Finns sitting nearby. People from Finland, you know. They appeared calm and unfazed, actually. And Kali shuffled over and asked them what they made of the situation. Ristu, who could speak English, explained that they did not think there was anything to fear. But then Finn's apparent lack of concern did nothing to ease their fears. Which, of course, I mean, huh? So they lay down on the ground, believing that they had reached the end, and that this might be the last night they would spend together. Overcome with deep sense of sadness and grief, they lay silently holding each other, too terrified to move or even talk. A thudding sound recurred intermediately during the 2 hours they were laying there. Now this thudding sound bothered Kali. He was sure at first, thought maybe it's a gunshot, like a silencer on or something. And then obviously he says, no, that's not it. But he didn't know exactly what it was, but it bothered him. Because in his mind it's something ominous, mean that word. Ominous? But I don't know of a better way to say it rather than using that. Ominous, yes. So that constantly still stayed with him. That took sound. Anyway. So while they're laying there, then they heard that familiar rumble 2 hours later of an engine in the distance. It broke the spell and they sat up, squinting into the dark. Suddenly they saw Sonia, Marie, and Renata, and the other hostages, all accompanied by a guard, walking towards them. They had merely been resting in another hut close by. So the hostages earlier, when you know Monique and Kali became one with it, with the mud, and they saw the hostages being taken to another place where Kali thought, you know, the worst and everything. It's them, but it just turns out they were just taken to another place to sleep. So that's good news, you know. So, relieved, Kali and Monique asked them if they were okay. It was all they could manage after torturing and draining themselves for the past 2 hours. And obviously they said they were okay, because but they're going to be saying, like, well, no, it's horrible. Like, they know what the situation is. Like, I mean, we're not in it, but you know, when people you ask walk in the street or wherever, and you meet some, see someone, you know, like, hi, how are you doing? You always say, I'm fine. You don't go like, someone else, how are you doing? Well, now, let's begin, you know? It's just, I'm fine. So, here's also, it's okay, you know? It is what it is. A sudden movement in the jungle caught Kali's eye, and he followed the object until it landed with a familiar thumping sound. You know, it's a poof sound. On the ground nearby. He finally understood for the first time that thudding sound, you know, the poof noise that he had been hearing all night that was bothering him, was that of ripe coconuts plopping off the trees and landing on the soft earth. Yep, that sound that bothered him for 2 hours was coconuts. But it's understandable. I mean, in a situation like that, expect the worst. Anyway, they transport two old 4x2 buckies, which in America is called trucks, called buckies, with wooden benches at the back, crash through the foliage with a while later. One of the rebels told Kali in a broken English that they referred to the vehicles as 6x6s, as it took 6 men to push one of them. Which, that is funny. I mean, okay. Having one of your hostage takers, men, with sense of humor, I mean, that's at least a good sign, I guess. It was around 11 p.m. When the woman captives were ordered onto the back of the trucks while the men were forced to walk alongside up a narrow, crappy jungle path. Many of the hostages were barefoot, but some managed to find flip-flops. You know, mud with flip-flops? I'd rather walk barefoot. Because you'd be sliding. No, not flip-flops. Kali had been given a pair of shoes, actual shoes, and Monique, who remained in the back of the truck, gave her flip-flops to Ken. They were heading uphill, and the terrain became increasingly impassable. The small convoy pushed on, and once the vehicles were less mud-bound, the men were allowed back on. The hostages at the back were tossed about like loose bits of equipment. Their teeth and bones rattled as they clung onto the sides. Because it's a crappy road, and it was shaking. About an hour later, they reached the top of a thing, and the rebels bundled into the back of the trucks with the hostages. And after another hour, on a dirt road, they spilled out onto a concrete highway. Well, their type of highway. You know, that from the hostages' point of view looked more like, you know, potholes back shit. Yes, because, okay. So, imagine, like, whole different country, whole different place. Like, the worst type of, well, you guys, most of you listening, I'm from a whole, for me, to me to you is like from a whole different world. But we have crappy roads, our highways ain't nothing like what I've seen, like, from American highways. No. So, even with that, just think of, like, the crappiest, tiniest road, barely paved, you can think of. That would be your highway. That would be their highway. Yeah? They're equivalent. So, yeah. Now, since they're now on the highway, they passed a few small, apparently deserted settlements along the way before arriving at a larger village where they discovered was called Talipal. The streets were empty except for the odd dog, chicken, or cow that strolled, you know, just strolled by across their path. You know, doing the whatever chickeny or cowy thing they do. The two trucks pulled up outside a house, and a young man with a ponytail ran indoors excitedly. This one of the rebels told Kali and Monique was their so-called headquarters. Someone else emerged with a crate of Coca-Cola, and soon the hostages were surrounded by yet another group of curious onlookers. Man, these people love their Coca-Cola. On the boat, when they arrived at the their first destination, first island, and then again, it's all about Coca-Cola. I wonder if they ever drink Sprite or something. Anyway, that wasn't where they would stay as they went on. The next camp, the Osages were assured would be much better than the first, and they gathered that this was where they were headed. And so they learned that, nope, they're not going to stay at their headquarters. Before the truck started up and headed off down the highway, the captives bundled onto the back. A rope was tied around them to prevent them from falling off during the bumpy ride. Now, just imagine how hectic that is, that you need to be tied down. This is not a roller coaster. This is not something in a theme park. This is it when you're on the back of a truck shaking that you need ropes. They moved along slowly for about 2 kilometers before the vehicles turned off down a mud path through the jungle. They sank almost immediately into the thick sludge. I mean, like, they should know by now. Yeah. The hostages were untied and ordered to walk up ahead while the rebels slid rather than pushed the stubborn trucks through the mud. Tired, confused, and exhausted, they reached the camp around 3 a.m. It was still black outside, but they could see that this site was exactly the same as the last. Wow, did they really expect people that have taken you hostage, holding you captive, would not lie to you? No showers, no beds, only flimsy huts on stilts and lots of new faces, peering inquisitively at them. They were desperately thirsty and furious when the rebels refused to let them drink from a jerry, but passed it around among themselves. Kali and Monique were ushered to a small bamboo shelter, while the rest of the hostages were taken to 2 separate huts in the same enclosure. Inside their hut was a young man with a kind face, the man with a ponytail, and 2 other guards. So, 4 people already. The space was cramped and awkward, and Kali and Monique tried to make themselves comfortable on that hard bamboo floor, but their bodies ached no matter how they lay. But exhausted, they fell asleep. But 2 hours later, the early morning call to prayer and the jabbering nasal voices that drifted from a portable radio that had been turned up full volume somewhere in the camp jolted them awake. As the sun rose, the camp stirred to life. Monique, her feet still brown with dry mud, was in a foul mood. Of course she's going to be in a foul mood. You wake up in a situation like that. I mean, the idea of a shower and a bed had kept her going the night before, and she could not bear to think of going yet another day without bathing or changing clothes. She told Kali that she was not going to move unless someone gave her water and a clean set of clothes. The young man, the one with the kind face, who spent the night with them in the hut, introduced himself as Patrick. He could speak perfect English, and he overheard Monique. That's when he strolled over to the rebel with the ponytail and stood talking before striding back, a huge grin on his face, carrying a clean grey t-shirt. He told Monique that the rebel had asked her that she return his combat jacket, which she did, forgetting the penknife, in the pocket, and in doing so, losing one of their most valuable finds. That was not a good moment. Later, he appeared with a cup of warm water for Monique. The couple walked off into the jungle, followed by a small crowd of curious onlookers. They found a secluded spot, and Kali shielded Monique with a thrusty bit of sheeting as she washed her hair and the rest of her body with the water. After that, Kali too managed to wash himself. They were amazed at what they had achieved with about 500 mils of water. Half a liter. I literally drank a liter of water before I started recording this. And I can't, 2 people find my water. And I'm coming from a country that suffers from drought. I mean, we are constantly suffering from drought. Going day, but yet, 500 more 2 people. No. But hey, desperate times are desperate measures. You can do anything in certain situations, okay? Anyway, they felt like marginally better afterwards and went to find other hostages. They came upon a furious Stephanie, who complained bitterly that the other hostages had not been able to sleep at all because of the constant noise and activity around their hut. Now, I know you're in a crappy situation, hence why when complaining about the noise, that you can sleep because of the noise, you were taken hostage, not taken to a chalet. But again, I would moan about everything, you know, complain literally about everything, because everything is, you can complain about everything, because it's so, you know, he was moody, irritable, tired, thirsty, and hungry. Basically, he was me every day of my life. Anyway, Kali and Monique obviously did not blame him. I mean, we could blame him in that situation. Sonia too looked pale and tired, as did the older German couple, especially Renata. The afternoon dragged on with no specific aim or purpose. The hostages and their captors sat around waiting for what? No one seemed to know. Now we're just chilling being hostages. Kali and Monique noticed that Patrick appeared to be on good terms with the soldier, with the bad skin, the acne prone one, and the one with the ponytail. And they went and asked him, what's going on? Who are you? Why do you know these people? Like, seem to know what's going on, you know, are you an inside man? Anyway, it was then that they learned that he was also hostage. And that's when Patrick went and to talk to the man with, you know, the acne prone skin, whose real name is Mujib Susukan, one of the rebel leaders, actually. The smaller rebel, you know, the one with the ponytail, was also a leader, but he did not tell Patrick his name. So, Kali and Monique was surprised. The two men who had appeared to wield a certain amount of control over the group, but they certainly did not look the part. While they sat around, Patrick explained that, you know, he was obviously a hostage as well. Just, I mean, that is a shock. But the fact that, how, you know, what happened. A native of the southern Philippine island of Hulu, which is spelled J-O-L-O, but it's Mount Hulu. Or, as they call it, House of Wasps, you know, locally. Patrick was caught in February 2000 while cycling around the island. I mean, here's this man just cycling around. Because, you know, that's what people do. And then next thing you know, you're like abducted. Anyway, he pointed to the bicycle he had been riding that day, and that it was now propped up against a hut, rusting in the tropical heat. The hostages still had no idea who the rebels were and what it was what they wanted. It was difficult to talk openly and within earshot of the guards, but one thing Patrick did tell Kali was that they should brace themselves for a long haul, perhaps even 3 months. I mean, that to any person in that situation, like, yay, that's great news. Kali was devastated at the news, of course, and was overcome by a gloomy heaviness. They'd only been on the island for 3 days and already found it unbearable. You know, sometimes when they say, like, news, but rather say nothing, I think in that situation, because that can break a person's morale. So? So. Yeah, okay, I had to end that on a dramatic. I like being over dramatic, so I had to leave it in the same moment. But yeah, so. We've reached the end of our fourth episode. We will be covering in the fifth episode how things were from the family's perspective, you know, and what happened, you know, in South Africa while this is going on, you know. So, a little different perspective, you know. I want to add it in, but actually, that because we're re-recording so many times, but it turned out to be so long. I don't want to be that long. Also, with that being said, I would like to thank Gisela K for the amazing intro. Yes. If you guys somehow forgot or something, you can go rewind back for that intro. Gisela K is an she doesn't just have a podcast, but she's also an author. She has 3 books published. The first one is Jeffrey Dahmer, The Milwaukee Monster. Second, Ted Bundy, The Campus Killer. The third, John Wayne Gacy, The Killer Clown. As well as an Instagram page where she posts some really interesting facts regarding serial killers and crime-related things. It's great. Guys, check it out. With including a podcast called Grizzly Books, which all of this you can find on her website. It's at www.grizzly-books.com. I will be leaving the links in the description of this episode for you guys to check it out. Definitely recommend checking it out. She is also an amazing supporter of True Crime Bones Patreon. And if you would like to be featured on the podcast, please consider joining the Patreon. Links will be available in the description as well as on my Instagram page at truecrime.bones. With that said, if you're still listening, you are a legendary, and thank you so much. And go check out Grizzly Books. Seriously, go check it out. Remember, stay safe. Crime never sleeps in South Africa. Ta-da!